And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Spotlight. We're delighted you can join us today. Spotlight is an event on For the People in which we interview a member of For the People, learn a little bit more about them, their life, and their life experiences. A couple of things before we get started. I'd like to thank Dennis for recording our Spotlight event for us for the purpose of archiving. And just to let you know that archives are available by going to the front page and clicking on the Galaxy of Stars link. And in there you'll find a link for Spotlight. It's a great opportunity to listen to interviews that have been done previously and you may have missed. We'll ask that you hold your questions and comments for our guest until the end of the interview. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the one and only Mr. Steve Pallett to introduce his guest for today. Steve?
Okay, thank you very much, Becky. And as Becky said, welcome to Spotlight, everyone. And today, I'm going to be talking to Amy Rake, a.k.a. Coffee Lady. And the reason why she's called Coffee Lady will become very apparent as we progress through the interview. But first of all, I'd like to say welcome, Amy, and thanks for agreeing to be interviewed. And can I ask you to begin by can I ask you where you were born?
Thanks, Steve. Well, I was born March 14th, 1948, in Paterson, New Jersey.
And just a little bit about your immediate family. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a brother who's older and a sister who's younger, so I was the middle child.
Okay, what about parents, mum and dad? What did they do for occupation?
My mother, when I was young, was a homemaker, and my father was always in the insurance business.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about your early childhood memories. What do you remember from when you were a very, very young girl growing up?
Well, I would just like to say first that I was born sighted. And through my younger years, there's one thing I don't remember not having is a television. I remember having a television that maybe the television screen was 5 inches big, but I remember watching it. And I went to kindergarten and through grade school in Paterson Public Education. And while I was doing that, I did normal things that young girls do. I was a brownie, and I was a Girl Scout. And I went on to high school in Paterson, and I graduated high school in 1965, and while in high school, in my junior and senior year, I had a part-time job at Alexander's department store.
Would you say you enjoyed school? Was it something that you enjoyed doing?
It was okay. I enjoyed it, but I enjoyed my summers more. I used to go to camp in the summer in Milford, Pennsylvania. And I made a lot of friends there, and later on in my interview I will continue about camp.
Yes, indeed. May I say, obviously, to the people listening, I've spoken to Amy before the interview, obviously, and everything that we say we've agreed that we'll talk about. So, yes, indeed, we'll come on to the part you played in the camp a little bit later in the interview. So what were your teenage years like then? Were you a girl for going out a lot, or a home-loving girl, or what? What about your teenage years, Amy?
My teenage years were good. I used to go down to the Y on Saturday night, and at school there was like a little luncheonette called the Cozy, and that's where everybody went. And I used to hang out there before school, after school, if I skipped class. Everybody used to go there. But my teenage years were normal, like most children.
And coming towards the end of your time at school, had you got any idea what you wanted to do? Any sort of ambitions, or was it pretty fluid at that time as to what you'd do after you left school?
No, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know if I wanted to go on to school or just get a job. But thinking about it, toward the end of the school year and into the summer, I decided to go to Mandel School for Medical and Dental Assistance in New York City.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about your training as a dental assistant? What sort of things did you learn?
Well, I decided to become a dental assistant, and I learned how to take x-rays, how to help the dentist at the chair side. I learned x-rays. I learned how to keep books and make appointments, and I learned an all-around education of what to do in a dental office.
So you were one of those people that handed the dentist the various instruments and things and helped with procedures. Did you have to learn a lot about dentistry, or in fact anything about dentistry itself, to enable you to do that?
No, I didn't have to learn about dentistry, but I did learn about the type of tools the dentist would need, how to mix the mercury for a filling, and make impressions for dentures and other things like that. But learning about dentistry, no.
Okay, and before you did that, were you bothered about going to the dentist, as personally? And during your time as a dental assistant, did you learn to understand the procedures that dentists were performing on people? And what I'm really trying to say is, did it eradicate any fear that you may have had personally of going to the dentist?
No, it didn't. In fact, it made made me more relaxed, because when I went to the dentist, because I knew what was happening and what was going on.
Yeah, I think that's everybody's dread, isn't it? I don't think there are many people that actually welcome going to the dentist, but with your inside knowledge, you obviously found it easier to actually do when it was your turn in the chair. So after training in this field, I would imagine that you actually got a job working with a dentist.
I got a job working with a dentist in Irvington, and I worked for him for about 5 years, and I really enjoyed it, but things had changed, and I left.
Okay, so we've got you being a dental assistant, and now you've left. What was the next big thing to happen to Amy after that point?
Well, while I was working there, I got married to my wonderful husband, Joe, in April of 1968. And after I stopped working for the dentist, Joe and I had been doing flea markets and selling jewelry. So that's antique reproduction jewelry, and that's what I was doing.
Okay, just briefly, can you just tell us a little bit about Joe, how you met him and where you met him, just for interest's sake, and then we'll come on to the flea market. But I'm just curious to know how and where you met your husband.
Well, I had a friend, Ellen, who called me and said, I'm having a party, and it's for Hadassah, and which is a Jewish organization, and would I like to come? And she said, I don't know, it would cost $5 for the party. So I said, yeah, I had nothing to do. So I went. And I met Joe that night.
Isn't it strange how these things happen? And if you hadn't have gone, well, who knows? You may not have met him, and that would have been dreadful thing to happen, so I'm glad you went, Amy. Now, you mentioned flea markets. Now, can you tell me, first of all, a little bit about a flea market? You know, what is a flea market? And secondly, the part that that you played in it.
Well, a flea market is where people who are vendors go and sell their wares. And they're either once a week or twice a week in one place, or they're in different places all the time. It depends on how the person wants to work a flea market.
So they're set up at random, are they? They're set up, they're not there permanently. Is it sort of a weekly event, and stalls are erected and things like that? Is that how it works?
Yeah, most of the time they're Saturday and they're Sunday. And Joe and I used to work on weekends. And while we were selling on weekends, we heard of this place in East Orange. And it was an indoor market. And we decided that we would, you know, go there. And we went and we met this couple. And we became friends. And one day Joe came and said that he found the place for us to have a store. And we thought he was kidding. And he said there's a new mall opening up that's going to have small stores. It's going to be called an antique village. So we went and looked at it. And we decided that we would open a store, and our friends opened a store also. And it was really great. I mean, I worked every day, you know, in the store, going to New York, buying and everything. I really had a lot of fun. And in the time that I had the store, I adopted my first child, Paul, from Bogota, Colombia.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Can I just take you back one step, Amy, and then we'll come on to the adoption. But you said you did antique reproduction jewellery. Just tell us a little bit about that. What sort of things were you selling? Or, you know, in your store? Because I think you had the flea market, then you bought a store, didn't you? Were you selling the jewellery in the store as well, or were you selling other antique items as well?
No, I was just selling the jewelry, and it was all jewelry that looked old, copy of old pieces, and it was custom jewelry, and it was marked reasonably priced, and it sold very well. During the time in the store, as I said, we adopted Paul, and I continued to keep the store open, and while Paul was a baby, I would bring him with me to the store, and when he got a little older, I found somebody to care for him during the day. And in the meantime, I became pregnant, and I didn't know I was pregnant. I was always heavy, and I had lost a lot of weight, and I thought I was just gaining weight. And one day I dropped Paul off at the babysitter. I went to the store, and even before I left, I was having these pains. Well, they were labor, and I didn't know it. And I put a note on my door of a store closed due to illness, and I went home. And I went home, and it was just horrible. So I called for help, and I got an ambulance, and I told the woman that I spoke to that my husband was working in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, at a newspaper. I gave her the name of the newspaper, and to please call him and, you know, tell him what's happening. So I went to the hospital, and the doctor examined me, and he said to me that I had a mass on my ovaries. Well, sure, it was a big mass. And And he said that he wanted to go and have x-rays taken. So I went and had an x-ray taken, and I don't know why, but they had to bring me back to the emergency room. And they told me that I was in labor. And I said to them, well, you know, the baby has to be dead because, I don't feel it. And they brought me to delivery, and they let me hear the heartbeat of the baby. And they gave me something that made me groggy, and I fell asleep. And the next thing I knew, I delivered a 6-pound, 1.5-ounce baby boy, Robert, on February 24th, 1978. And in the meantime, when Joe was working in Bethlehem, we decided that we would move there. So we moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And before we moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, I didn't know, but I was pregnant with Adam. And one day I said to my friend, my girlfriend, I think I'm pregnant. What am I going to do? Here Paul is not even 2. Robert is an infant. And here I'm pregnant again. And she said to me, well, Amy, if you're pregnant, you'll do what you have to do. And I went to the doctor, and sure enough, I was pregnant. Well, I kept thinking about this, and how was I going to take care of 3 little boys? And with my 3rd pregnancy, I became very sick with toxemia. I broke my leg, and I had to have help in the house. And I had this lovely woman that came in every day and took care of the children and me. And everything was working out pretty smoothly with her in the house. And one day I went to the doctor during my last trimester because I was having a lot of problems. He said to me, Amy, just walk across the street and go into the hospital, and you're not coming out until you deliver. Well, so I went into the hospital, and I think I was there a week, and they did an amniocentesis to see if the baby's lungs were ready to develop, developed enough to be delivered, and they were, and they said to me that on Saturday morning I was going to have a cesarean section. And on February 17th, 1979, Adam was born. Here Paul was born in September of 1976, Robert in February of 78, and Adam in February of 79. On Robert's first birthday, we had a bris, which is a religious circumcision for Adam. So the two boys are 51 weeks apart. And it was hard. And in the meantime, Joe was offered a job in Ohio. And off we went to Mansfield, Ohio. Well, we didn't like it. We were sorry we ever went, and we wanted to come back to the metropolitan area. And a year and a half later, we did. And we moved to Parsippany into an apartment, and because we couldn't afford to buy a house here yet, because we didn't make that much money on our house in Ohio, and the difference in prices were outrageous. So we lived in the apartment for a year and a half, and finally we were able to buy our home in Parsippany. And the children grew up in this home, and it was wonderful. It was just a lovely, happy family. Mom worked, dad worked, children went to school. We had 3 bar mitzvahs, and everything was going well.
Okay, that's quite a big chunk there to digest, Amy. Can I, again, take you back just a little way back in your story, because you mentioned before about your own children, which must have been a big, big surprise to you, but obviously a delight as well, that you did actually adopt a baby from Bogota. Now, can you tell us, first of all, why from Bogota, and a little about the procedure you had to go through to actually get a baby from Bogota?
In 1975, we were married for a long time, and I hadn't become pregnant. And Joe and I decided that we would adopt the baby. And a friend of mine turned me on to a woman who adopted a baby from a lawyer in Florida. And we contacted this lawyer in Florida and sent him everything that he wanted and a retainer. And, you know, we were happy. We were on our way of getting a baby. And every once in a while I would call to see, you know, what was happening, how much longer. And one day I called and nobody answered the phone. And I called another time and another time and nobody answered the phone. And one day I called and it said, this number has been disconnected. Well, I can't tell you. I was just so upset that here it is, something that I've been waiting for a long time. And this attorney took my money and ran away. And Joe worked for a newspaper at the time, and he talked to one of the editors, and they did a newspaper article. And this is about Christmas of 1975. It was around Christmas time of 1975. And I was working hard in the store during Christmas, during the Christmas shopping season, and, you know, going in early and closing very late. And Joe and I came home one night, and we were sitting having a cup of coffee, and my phone rang, and we looked at each other, who's calling us so late at night? Well, it was a woman, and I knew she didn't know who I was because she didn't pronounce my name properly. And I said, yes, you know, I'm the person that you're looking for. And she said to me, if you want to adopt a baby, I can help you. She says, I've adopted 2 children within 1 year. Well, at that time, I was busy, I was tired, and I really wasn't interested in looking into adopting a baby somewhere else at exactly at that time. And I said, can I have your name and your number, and I'll get back to you. So after Christmas season, I did call her, and she invited us over, and we saw her children, and one of her children came from the Texas Cradle Society, and her other child came from Bogota, Colombia. And there was an organization called Latin American Parents for Adoption. And she invited us to a meeting, and we went to a meeting, and we were told everything that we had to do to apply for an adoption in Colombia. And Joe and I ran around, did all the paperwork, and went to the Colombian consulate in New York, and turned our papers in, and off they went to the orphanage. And we didn't tell anybody in our family that we were doing this until after the papers were done. And I don't know, my parents weren't very happy. You know, they didn't know what the child was going to look like, and, well, I really didn't care. And I would call the orphanage in Colombia every once in a while, and they would say, not yet, not yet. And one day I called, and they had a bulletin board. And if your name hit the board, you are very, very close to having a baby. And I called, and they said, your name has been put on the blackboard. So I said, well, how much longer? And she says, well, I don't know. And we, so we waited, and one day I called again in the afternoon. And she said to me, well, I'll call you 8 o'clock tonight. And she called us 8 o'clock that night. It was on a Wednesday, and said to us that she had a little boy for us. And Sunday, we were off and on our way to Columbia because we had to be at the orphanage Monday morning.
Wow, what a story. What an incredible chain of events that was. And obviously you got to the orphanage and you found the baby you were looking for.
Yeah, there was Paul. And we waited almost all day for him. It was just incredible. I mean, we couldn't understand what was happening. And finally my husband heard something that they didn't have the thumbprint of the mother on certain paper. So we know now that somebody in the orphanage put their thumbprint on the paper so that we can continue on with our adoption. And we did. We got Paul late in the afternoon, and we took him to the consulate doctor because that was one of the steps that had to be done for him to leave the country. And when we were leaving the doctor's office for the consulate, he asked us if we were going to take him to another doctor, and my husband said yes. Well, the reason why he asked us was because Paul had pneumonia, and we had to put him into the hospital. So Joe called the orphanage, because we were supposed to bring him back that evening, and told them that Paul had to go into the hospital because he has pneumonia. And the only thing they cared about was who was going to take care of the bill to the hospital. And Joe said to them, that I will take responsibility for the payment of the bill. I guess babies to them were like nothing. They were like a piece of candy, because they said to him, if anything happens, you know, to him, we can give you another child.
Oh, what a fantastic attitude. I don't think that's dreadful. Anyway, obviously it all turned out right, and you went back home, and then, as you've told us, you had your other children, your own children naturally. And now, can we just jump forward a little bit to the time that you moved back to New Jersey with your family? You said that you moved and you didn't like it, and you moved back again to New Jersey. So what happened after that?
Well, 1981, we moved back to New Jersey, and Joe got a job right away. And we were really happy. And the boys grew up. And I was busy during that time, driving everywhere and going everywhere. It just seemed like I never left the car. I was like a private chauffeur. But it was enjoyable watching them grow up and turning into wonderful men.
Yeah, I'm sure that they were a great, great source of happiness in your life, and I'm sure you're very proud of them. But they're very proud of you as well. I think you told me when we spoke earlier in the week that round about this time you were doing a little job as a school bus driver.
Yeah, while the kids were little, I drove a bus, school bus, a small one, and because I could take the little one with me, and it was easy, and it just brought in a little extra income. And once they all went to school in around 1985, somebody said to me that the New Jersey Y camp was looking for somebody to work full-time. Well, New Jersey Y Camp's office was only like 10 minutes from my house in Fairfield, and it would really be nice to go back to the New Jersey Y Camp where I grew up as a child in the summer. So I applied for the job, and I got it. And I worked there for 10 summers. 10 summers I went to camp in Pennsylvania, like I did as a child, and worked full time in the office. And that was, you know, during the summer. And spring and summer I worked camp. And they also had another program for senior adults. They had a camp for senior adults, which I did not get involved with, but they had a program for senior adults, sending them to Florida. And I did all of it. I made all their arrangements and everything and got them on a plane and to Florida and to the hotels. And that was a lot of fun also. After 10 years, my job was eliminated, and they offered me another job, but I didn't want it because I'm not a bookkeeper, and I didn't want to learn. So I left, and I was collecting unemployment. And while I was collecting unemployment, they said that that they would send me to school if I wanted to. So I figured, well, you know, I'm 50 years old. I'll go to school. So I went to school. I went to Berdan Institute for Medical and Dental Assistance. But this time I decided that I was going to go into the medical field, and I became a medical receptionist, and I worked for a dermatologist for 5 years in Morristown. And while I was working for the dermatologist, my eyesight started to go. And I worked for a while. I would go to a low vision doctor, and he would give me glasses, my bifocal would be magnetized so I could, see better. They tried putting this thing over my screen of my computer to magnify it, but it just didn't work. And I gave up my job. It'll be 3 years Thanksgiving. I gave up my job. I gave up driving. It just seemed like I gave up my world.
Yeah, big shock. Big shock, Amy, to you. Must have been. Did you have any idea that you may be diabetic? I mean, did it occur to you that things were not as they should be?
Well, yes, because when I went to my ophthalmologist, she recommended me going to a retina specialist. And I went, and he told me that I had retinopathy, and I had laser treatments. But, maybe the bleeding would stop for a while, but it would start up again. And one night, he just said to me, Amy, that you're legally blind and there's really not very much I can do for you. So that upset Joe and I very much. Why can't you do something? Can't you operate? There's nothing that he can do. Well, okay, so we left and we decided that, we would go to another retina specialist and see what he would say. And in the meantime, I woke up one morning that week with a massive hemorrhage in my eye, and I called my low vision doctor because I didn't have another doctor to go to because, I didn't want to go back to that retina specialist because, what did he do? Nothing. So we went to the low vision doctor, and he sent me to another retina specialist that day, and he said to me that he would like to do a vitrectomy on the eye to remove the blood and the scar tissue from the laser. And we said, okay. So we did that, and I had more laser treatment, and things were, they didn't get better. But they didn't get worse. And then one day he said to me that he would like to do a vitrectomy on my other eye to remove all the scar tissue because he said that he thought that I might see better. And, I didn't see better, but I don't see any worse. And my eyes have stayed stable since then. But not being able to drive and not being able to go anywhere was very depressing to me. Because I was very, very active. I was never home. I was running here or going there or working or whatever. And here I am in my house. It seemed like 7 days a week, or maybe once Joe and I would go out for dinner, or, I don't know, maybe go out for breakfast, go food shopping, but it was nothing like it was. And Amy became very depressed. And in January of 2001, I signed myself into the hospital. I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and they thought that I was ready to go home, and my depression had, you know, eased up, and they set me up with a psychiatrist and a therapist and medication, and I was to go. Well, I went to the psychiatrist, and I went to the therapist, and it didn't help me because all I was home in the house again and looking at the four walls, and I couldn't stand it. So, you know, nobody was home, and I was alone. And one day I decided, well, this is it. I don't want to live anymore. Well, I said to myself, how am I going to do this? How am I going to die? Well, I said to myself, if I take more insulin than I'm supposed to, I could kill myself. So that's what I did. I took insulin, a lot of it, and didn't eat. And my son came home at 5 o'clock, and I was out of it. He called 911, and back into the hospital I went. And I was there for about 10 days, 2 weeks, and I don't know, they gave my husband a name of a place where I can go during the day, because my husband didn't want to leave me home anymore. And we went to look at it, and it was all very, very, very old people. And I said to him, I'm not going here. In the meantime, you know, after getting out of the hospital, I went to a day center at another hospital for psychiatric treatment. So I was there for about 3 months. And when I left there, I had a caseworker through my insurance company, because I was a patient at risk. And she would come and see me and talk to me. And one day she said to me, Amy, it would be good for you to go to a support group. So she was looking through the book of all support groups. And there was a support group that met once a month on Wednesdays. And it was for Morris County people, and it was called the VIP. And the VIP met at Diamond Spring Lodge.
I know it may be difficult for you, Amy, but can you try and explain to us the thought processes that were going on in your head during this time while you were in hospital? What sort of things were going through your head as you sat in the hospital?
Well, I still didn't want to live. I mean, how am I going to live like this? And, you know, I'm not going to be able to continue my life the way it was. And it was very hard. But my family was very supportive. And I have a sister who's a doctor in psychology, and she really took over my case and talked to the doctors and everything and made sure that I got the right medication. And she's, you know, she still watches. And after, you know, the caseworker told me to go to Diamond Spring Lodge, you know, to go to the VIP, and they met at Diamond Spring Lodge, I learned something about Diamond Spring Lodge. And I heard that they had a computer course, and the computer course were for the blind and visually impaired. And, I kept saying I was going to call. I told my therapist that I was going to call and I was going to, you know, make an appointment and I wanted to take this course. And I kept talking about it, but I didn't do anything about it. And one day during my session, he picked up the phone and he called Diamond Spring Lodge. And he talked to Andrew Godwin, and he told him something about me and said that I was interested in the course. And Andrew took my name and number and said that he would get back to me. Well, Andrew did, and he said the course was going to start in February and that he would give me a call. Well, he gave me a call, and they provided me transportation to the lodge. And I went, and I started taking computer courses. And that summer, I volunteered at the lodge, and I went every day. And in the fall, I went back to computer classes. And things were good, you know. I was getting out every day, and I had a place to go. And, I was feeling better about myself. And while I was there, I was happy. I met a lot of friends. I met my best friend, Rich. And then I stopped going and went back in the fall. I stopped going over in August, and I came back in the fall for classes. And Rich stopped going. So, at least we talked to each other. And Rich, the Yankees, is going to win tonight. And that's how my life has been.
Okay. It's obviously a very, very difficult thing for you to talk about, and we're very, very grateful for you actually sharing it with us. It can't be easy. These things that happen to us, you know, they're not easy to express in words, and you know, you've obviously come through it all. Let's get on to more cheerful things, Amy, after that very, very heavy session, and come on to your interesting coffee. Now, you're called Coffee Lady on for the People for a very, very good reason, and tell us why you're known as Coffee Lady.
Well, I would say back in the early 1990s, my two younger sons and myself started going to the flea market and selling cheesecakes and cookies. And it was for fun to send my oldest son to college. We were going to work and save money for his college tuition. And in the meantime, Joe lost his job at the newspaper, and he decided that he was going to go into the flea market business full time. Well, it was okay, because flea markets then were really good, and we decided that we would bring coffee into one of our items. And we did that, and coffee went very well. And we sold a lot of coffee and a lot of, you know, cookies and cheesecakes and whatever, and we were doing very, very well. And there was a flea market in Chester, New Jersey. It was one of the biggest flea markets ever. And it was in a prime location. It was in a small town. And people would come in groves. And when they closed their flea market in Chester, it just seemed like all the flea markets went down the drain. They just weren't doing well at all. And we continued doing them, but we would split up. We would each take one child. One would go to one flea market, one would go to another flea market. And it just seemed like I was working 7 days a week, and I just, once I got sick, I couldn't do it anymore. And so Joe got a job as a limousine driver, which he does now. And I don't know, when I got sick, I decided, and I, you know, I got better, I decided, oh, I have to do something. So I decided that I would sell coffee. And we put a website on the internet, which we took off because we weren't happy with our the company that was holding our server. And we're going to open one on Yahoo, hopefully by the end of November, and be back in business. But that's how I became the coffee lady.
Oh, fantastic. And obviously you when you do sell your coffee, it's an internet-based company. Will you be selling to individual people or to companies or what?
No, we sell to individual people.
Internationally or just across the US at the moment?
Well, we haven't sold internationally yet, but we would.
We'll have to order some of these exotic coffees from you when you're back in business, because I wouldn't say we can't get them over here in the UK, but they're probably harder to find than they are over there. Can you just run through some of the different varieties that you do sell, Amy? What do you get up to?
Well, I have the normal flavors. I have French vanilla, hazelnut, Swiss chocolate almonds, and my favorite is apricot and cream, banana Foster. I have chocolate-covered peanut butter. There's hundreds. Caramel nut fudge. There's so many different brands, and they have pumpkin during this holiday season, and they have a Christmas coffee. So they have, you know, coffee for all different seasons, and you know, it's a lot of fun. It, you know, it keeps me busy.
I'm sure it does. Do you sell the coffee ground, or do you sell the beans, or whatever people want?
Whatever people want. If they want it whole bean, they get it whole bean. If they want it ground, they have to tell us how they want it ground.
And can you give people a little bit of advice about storage of coffee? How do you think people should store their coffee when it arrives from you?
Just keep it in your cabinet, and it stays fresh. People say, oh, put it in the freezer, put it in the refrigerator. Coffee stays fresh just in the cabinet.
Okay, and how do you make the perfect pot of coffee, would you say? What would your advice be to get a really, really tasty cup?
Well, I grind my coffee fresh to make a pot of coffee, and I just take the top of my coffee grinder, I fill it with beans, put it in the grinder, and grind it. I mean, that's it.
Okay. Well, we all think that in America you're probably the experts at making coffee. And when you get back on the internet, we'll certainly be buying some from you. And no doubt your new website address will be available to For the People members. How did you first find out about For the People?
Well, going to the lodge and taking the computer class, and Andrew and Rich always talked about For the People. And while we were in class, they, you know, had us register. And I registered, and I would come on once in a while, I was afraid. I'm a very shy person. And, I would come on and I would say hello, but then I didn't say anything. I wouldn't talk, or I had nothing to say. But I've been on now a year and a half, and I really enjoy it. It's one of the best sites and one of the best things that happened to me, because I'm never alone in my house.
Absolutely not. I think we can all identify with that, Amy. We've always got someone to talk to all over the world. It's incredible. We're coming towards the end of our time now. I'm just going to ask you one more heavy question, and then we'll have a bit of fun at the very, very end. What would you say is your greatest achievement? What are you most proud of in your life so far?
Well, I'm proud of my three boys. They grew up to be really, really wonderful men. I never had a problem with them growing up with drugs or anything like that. I mean, they stayed by curfew and they listened, and it really made me proud when people would always say to me, oh, you know, your son is such a nice boy, or, you know, that's the best thing that ever happened to me, is my three children.
That's wonderful. That really is great. Okay, I'm going to surprise you with this. I did this the last spotlight I did. I'm going to give you very, very little thinking time. I want you to answer these questions as quickly as you can, and we'll just try and find out a little bit more. You needn't worry. What's your favourite drink?
Diet Coke.
Okay, and your favourite food?
Tuna fish.
Movie?
When Harry Met Sally.
Okay. Piece of music?
I like you up.
Time of year?
Spring.
And finally, your favorite method of relaxing?
Playing Crazy Eights.
And winning, probably. Okay, Amy, thanks a million for your time. I know it's probably been a bit of an ordeal at times during this interview. I'd like to thank you most sincerely for sharing your life with us. And I don't know if you're willing to answer any questions from these good people here in the room, but if you are, now's the time to ask Amy anything you'd like to ask. And I'm sure you all agree that she's a very courageous lady, and it's a great pleasure getting to know you, Amy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve, and yes, I will answer questions.
Amy, great interview, and thank you for the compliment. And I feel the same way. I met a true friend when I met you and Diamond Spring Lodge, and that's the way we're going to stay.
Thanks, Rich.
Great interview, Amy. I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was wonderful. And yes, she is ruthless when it comes to Crazy Eight. Let me just tell everybody that. I really thank you for your interview. It was wonderful.
Amy, I'd like to know, first of all, I want to say that at least Amy sticks in Crazy Eight even when she's losing, like, unlike some other people. And secondly, do you have a variety pack of coffee?
I can make one.
I'll talk to you about it some other time, but I'd like to get some for Christmas.
Okay. It'll be fine.
That was a great interview, Amy. I'm proud of you. And you have a great Crazy Eight player.
Thanks, Anita.
Well, I want to thank everyone for coming to Spotlight today, and good interview and great job to both Steve and Amy. In 2 weeks, we'll be back with Spotlight, and our most favorite veteran, Ricky, will be our guest on Spotlight. So I hope to see everybody back then in 2 weeks.